You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Jason Stellman. Jason Stellman is a convert to the faith. He's the author of a new book called Misfit Faith. You were telling your story about how you wound up as a Catholic before we went to break.
Yeah, I got pretty serious about my faith when I was in high school, when I joined a big church in Southern California, and there were a bunch of kids who took their faith seriously, and it had a pretty profound effect on me, and so I followed suit. I served on the mission field with that church in Africa and in Europe, and I began pastoring a Presbyterian church up in the Seattle area in 2004. And I did that until 2012, but it was the period of time between 2008 and 2012, my last 4 years in the ministry. That's when I got really plagued by issues surrounding the Catholic Church, especially issues about authority and the role of Scripture and the role of the church and all of that. And Mark, you were part of that plague, because one of the first books I read was your book, By What Authority? And that certainly didn't help me retain my Presbyterianism at all. But after 4 years of struggle, though, both around those issues as well as around issues concerning the gospel and the role of works and faith and salvation, all of that, I just lost that battle. And so I stepped down from my ministry and was received into the church in 2012 at the end of the year.
Okay. All right. And it's been just nothing but smooth sailing ever since, right? I mean,
oh yeah, it's hard. I don't even know what to do with all the money I'm making. It's crazy.
Wait, we make money at this?
Oh yeah, that's what it's all about, man.
Right.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I have very much enjoyed the time that we, you know, have spent together, you know, poolside, counting our money, hanging out, Kim and Kanye, and doing lines of coke like you do. It's all the Soros money.
It's so good.
It's such, because he actually, a lot of people don't know this, but George Soros actually pays in gold coins. So you've written a book called Misfit Faith. It's not your first book, by the way.
No, it's my third book.
Yeah. Talk about the other two books. I'm familiar with The Destiny of the Species, which is,
there's a blur by you on the back of that one.
Yes.
The first book I wrote was written mostly from the standpoint of a hardcore Presbyterian. It's called Dual Citizens, Worship and Life Between the Already and the Not Yet. I was transitioning, though, to Catholic. You can find places in that book where I sound really Catholic, and that's because at the time of writing it, I was wrestling with those issues. But it mostly looks at kind of what the new covenant means and how it bears upon our worship as a church and our lives as individuals. Misfit Faith, I think I learned a lot about how not to write a book from those first two. And this most recent one is the one that I'm most proud of, cool. No question about it.
Well, yeah. Talk about it. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it started out very different, you know, because when I was a Protestant, I was very, very polemical. I was very much into arguing and debating and all of that. Like you mentioned in the intro, I was the prosecutor in a heresy trial against a fellow minister. I mean, I was that kind of person. And when I started writing Misfit Faith, I still kind of was that way as a Catholic. And I assumed that the book is going to be this big defense of me, you know, joining the dark side of the force, you know, and becoming a Catholic. And I actually wrote a whole manuscript that I submitted that was very much, you know, that way. It was very kind of case making and argumentative. But I had experienced such a profound existential shift in within myself where I just no longer had that bloodlust for debates and proving other people wrong and proving myself right, that I just really hated. I hated the book I wrote, and I asked my publisher, can I just start from scratch? And he said yes. And so Misfit Faith resulted, and it's very much, I mean, it touches a little bit upon my theological move, but it more chronicles the subsequent shift in me that, you know, I came to a point where I just realized, you know, it's got to be about grace, because if it's not, then I'm just screwed and I have no hope. And God has to be a father. He can't be primarily a judge, because that's kind of how I thought about him before, is, you know, he gave man his law, man rebelled, God, you know, sentenced him to eternal, you know, suffering. And but then God poured out his wrath and seething anger upon Jesus so that he could forgive us and acquit us in the courtroom of heaven. My paradigm was very, very legal. You know, it was very forensic. Uh-huh. And God was very much a judge. Uh-huh. And I reached a point where, you know, just kind of reading the early fathers and reading the Catechism of the Catholic Church and thinking about the Trinity and all these things that the Catholic Church emphasizes, I just kind of concluded that if God is a judge, then I don't even like him, let alone love him. I don't even like him.
Right.
But if he's a father, I can connect with that, because I'm a father too. And I'm thinking that God's probably a better father than I am. And if that's true, then the ramifications are huge, both for how I look at God, but also how I see myself. And that really is what the book kind of teases out in a bunch of different ways.
Okay. That sounds really good. I haven't had a
chance. Yeah, you should totally read it, man.
I you know, it's funny you should say this. I've been thinking about this just today. I'm writing a piece on the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And basically arguing for the church's position on the death penalty, which has, you know, as we know, has seen a shift. I mean, there's been for a good long time, most of the history of the church, the church, you know, approved of the death penalty, not without reservations, by the way, but said, yeah, okay. And in the last 20 years, really, the church has just said, we just need to abolish it. It's just... get rid of it, you know. And one of the arguments against this shift that you run into a lot is this notion of retributive justice. We have to have the death penalty because eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and et cetera, et cetera. And this is the fitting punishment for murder and so forth. And the thing is that even the lex talionis, speaking of a legal approach to God, what's striking about the lex talionis is that the purpose of it is to limit vengeance, not to inflict it. Because the danger was always not life for life, but tribe for life, life for eye, life for tooth, life for, you know, you put one of ours in the hospital, we put one of yours in the morgue. And the whole reason for the lex talionis was to try to limit that. And the reason for the death penalty, you know, whoever sheds man's blood by man shall his blood be shed. That was a concession to weakness, not a positive command saying, you know, kill as many people on death row as you could possibly kill.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, when we look at, when Jesus looks at the lex talionis, he says, whoever strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And he specifically cites that text, you know, and then we see him live it out. So when everybody is laughing at him while he's dying, his response is, forgive them, they know not what they do.
Yeah, and I think the church and Christianity as a whole loses a lot of people because people have not been trained or encouraged to think about God as a father, you know? Sure, like, but when I was a Protestant, like, of course I knew the Trinity, I knew the verses. If Mormons knocked at my door, I was ready with the verses to show them that God is three in one. But it didn't function powerfully at all. in my thinking or in my life. And I think is when we let God, when we relate to him in that legal way, as a, in a servile, cowering fear, then of course it's not sustainable, and it's a matter of time until people just get so burdened that they walk away.
Right.
And that's kind of, you know, the person I'm writing this book for, you know, it's to encourage people to remember that God is a father, and that that changes everything for me anyways. It certainly did.
Well, what brought that change about? I mean, in my experience, usually those changes come from suffering.
That was part of it, you know, because my I was struggling with all of these Catholic questions as a minister. I didn't have anyone I could talk to because, you know, I was sort of a Protestant on steroids, you know, and we're supposed to be the whole reason our church exists is because of the you know, the Roman error, and we're the antidote to that problem. And so it doesn't create really a context where you can sort of divulge to your fellow ministers that you're you kind of think Catholicism might be okay. So there was a crucible. Yeah, there was a crucible there. I'd be happy to talk more about it after the break.
Yeah. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens and Mr. Jason Stellman, author of Misfit Faith, which, by the way, you can get on Amazon. We'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Michael Litchens and Jason Stellman. Jason Stellman is not only is he the author of Misfit Faith, which we're discussing right now, but he is also one of the two partners in crime, along with Christian Kingery. Is it Kingery? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yep, that's right.
They do a podcast, which you really should go out and find because it's oodles of fun, called Drunk Ex-Pastors. So you can go out and check out the drunk, just Google Drunk Ex-Pastors. It'll take you right to their podcast. And you can hear him and Christian in their native habitat talking about, well, all kinds of things. But right now we're talking about Misfit Faith. So you were talking about this change that you underwent, in which you really began to kind of lose the, Christianity as arena for forensic sparring.
Yeah, I was one of those guys, you know, I was one of those guys on the internet that just loved to, fight and argue. And I've always been that way. I mean, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin type discussions. I've always been into that. But as I was sharing earlier, you know, I lost a lot of that or almost all of that desire for debate after I became Catholic. And I think part of it is, and I talk about it in the book, you know, along with the audacious nature of the claims of the church about herself comes or ought to come a kind of ironic humility, because the church doesn't say we are one denomination in the, you know, in the pantheon of options out there for you. Try the Methodists, try the Episcopalians, give us a shot. The church thinks of herself as the church that's just kind of always been here and always will be. And we're not a denomination. We're just the one that was here first. And, you know, when you think about that, it's a very audacious claim. But what I found really interesting in my own heart, as I was, you know, becoming more and more comfortable with that claim, what I found interesting was that it produces a humility, because you don't any longer feel the need to justify your existence. You know, as a Protestant and as a Presbyterian especially, I felt the need to justify the existence of my church because we're here to clean up the mess that the medieval Catholic Church made. And that's what Luther was for. That's what Calvin was for. And that's why we're here. We're the antidote to this prior problem. Mm-hmm. And so you need an enemy. You need a foil. You need some boogeyman to legitimize your own place at the table, right?
Yeah.
But when you become Catholic, all of a sudden it's like, well, if all the churches that oppose us disappeared tomorrow, it wouldn't make any difference. Like, we would just keep doing what we're doing. You know, we don't need them to exist. We don't need to spar and fight in order. We're the mother. We're not a rival sibling.
Right.
We're the mother of all the faithful.
Right.
And that really, I mean, that kind of theological point really sunk down deep into me on an existential level. And that is largely what accounts for my loss of the desire to argue or prove myself to be right.
Isn't that interesting? I haven't lost that part of me. The thing is what I want is I want to know what's going on. That's kind of why I argue with people, is so I can figure out what's going on, you know? that was how medievals figured out what was going on. Argue comes from a Latin word that means to clarify. And so when I argue, I mean, what I really want to do is I want to argue. I don't want to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get at things and figure out what's going on. And if that's going on, then I'm happy. But if it's just, you know, the argument clinic from Monty Python, then it's like, this is a waste of time, you know. So, yeah, anyway. Talk a little bit about your book discusses grace and nature. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, there's this, you know, motif running through Catholic thought, you know, especially from St. Thomas, about grace perfects nature. You know, when we talk about nature, we're talking about not just like mountains and rivers and streams. We're talking about all the earthly stuff, the humanity, right? And when we talk about grace, we're talking about the heavenly stuff, the eternal stuff, divinity. And so the question is, and I think it's the biggest question on a practical level you can ask, is what's the relationship of grace to nature? What's the relationship of heaven to earth, divinity to humanity? As a Protestant, and especially as an evangelical Protestant, there's the very real sense in which grace comes in to fix nature, to correct nature. Right. Mm-hmm. And like a practical example of this is you can't listen to secular music because secular music is not Christian. Mm-hmm. It's secular, and secular means bad. And so we have to have Christian radio stations and contemporary Christian music in order to provide a version of these songs that's OK. Right.
As well with Christian movies. Right. Yeah.
Christian movies, all of it. It's implicitly a Christological error that they're making, because the lens, and this is something I learned, especially being a Catholic and thinking a lot about the incarnation of the Son, the lens through which we should think about this stuff is Jesus, right? Jesus is a divine person who assumes a human nature. And did his divinity crush his humanity? Did his divinity take his humanity over, bypassing it, like when a human gets bitten by a zombie and they just become under the spell of this zombie virus? No. The divinity of Christ existed in perfect harmony with his humanity to the point where he rose in the flesh and ascended into heaven with his human nature, forever exalting our nature and our humanity. And if that is all true, then I don't have to be afraid of the world anymore. I don't have to be afraid of my own weakness, my own humanity. I don't have to deny or be afraid of my own flesh and treat every non-explicitly Christian, expression of human culture as some sort of threat. But I can see God in it. I can see beauty in something simply for its own humanity. And I really think that this issue is something that the more you tease out the ramifications of it, the more just you know, inexhaustible the topic becomes, the more bottomless the well from which you can draw application from this principle is.
One of the things that the documents of the Second Vatican Council, I think it's Lumen Gentium, says, is a very shocking statement, says that human beings are the only creatures that God has made for their own sake.
Mm.
Which is one of the reasons, of course, that, you get entire anthropologies out of that, which have baffled quite a number of Catholics who've been shocked to hear the church saying things that sounded to their ears indistinguishable from secular humanism.
Mm-hmm.
And yet are perfectly Catholic. So, you know, merely to affirm human life is already to be affirming something essentially Christological, because God has assumed human nature.
To expect everything the church says to be in marked contrast from anything the world would say is to implicitly assume that Jesus, when he opened his mouth, didn't just speak the lingua franca Aramaic of his day, but rather spoke in some special, like, God code, some Trinity code that no one could understand. Jesus was, it's like when he came to Nazareth and started saying all these things about himself, everyone was like, this guy's just the carpenter's son. We know this guy. Who does he think he is? They didn't think, oh my God, we knew that he was going to be something special his whole life because he's got that halo that glows around his head all the time, or he walks 3 feet off the ground. No, Jesus was human. He looked human to everybody. Even Judas had to kiss him in the garden to let the Romans know which one to arrest, right?
Right.
And yeah, I think we must make a big mistake when we expect anything Christian to be a kind of antidote to, or in marked contrast from, anything the world might say.
Yeah, it's a failing that manifests itself in all kinds of different ways. You know, as an evangelical, one of the things that I kind of took for granted was exactly this sort of, you know, well, there's the world, which you're supposed, and the world didn't mean, you know, the fallen cosmic system. It really did tend to mean something almost Gnostic. There's, you know, anything that's not churchy is the world, right? And so, you know, movies, secular music, and, all the stuff that you do when you're not at church, that was all the world. And what really grabbed me about the faith was the incarnation and the realization that, God had manifested himself in a human way through human things and not made an end run around them. It was one of the main reasons that I became Catholic. But then I discovered that, like, Catholics also have other strategies for making exactly the same kind of mistake. So, forms of piety and stuff like that. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Michael Litchens and Mr. Jason Stellman. And we will be back talking about misfit faith right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Michael Litchens from Catholic Exchange and Mr. Jason Stellman, who is the co-host of the Drunk Ex-Pastors podcast, which you should really rush right out and find. And you can just Google it, you'll find it. And also the author of a brand new book called Misfit Faith. We were talking a little bit about that dynamic of grace and nature. Can you talk about, I guess, some of the ways in which you've seen St. Thomas's, that grace builds on nature? That, by the way, is a different thing than say sometimes grace fixes nature where it's been damaged by sin. But also grace just builds on nature. Grace, part of the, again, one of the reasons I became Catholic was because the Catholic understanding of grace in nature was that nature's a good thing, not a mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was hugely attractive to me. I was wondering if you could talk about places where you've seen grace build on nature in your life.
Well, yeah, Chesterton has this great line where he says, when people fault the church because a lot of her feasts and festivals and practices are just baptized versions of pagan feasts and festivals and practices, Chesterton said, of course that's true, because mankind was human before mankind was Christian. And so why wouldn't grace come along and build upon nature?
Yeah.
I'm the kind of person who finds God in seemingly in all the wrong places. Whether it's a piece of music, or I'm into movies and TV and those kinds of cultural products. And, there have long been, certain films that just move me in such a powerful way. Yeah. And there's always the temptation as an evangelical to feel guilty because the person, the director of this film or the person who wrote the screenplay, they're not Christian. And so their wisdom is the wisdom of the world, which is, of course, wrong. And Christianity exists to correct everything wrong with the world, which is pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. For me, realizing that Christ assumed humanity and participated and to this day participates in our humanity, in our human nature, having even glorified it in the resurrection, mm-hmm. and ascended to heaven with it in the ascension, it really changes the way you look at the world. And it really changes the way you relate to other people, too.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've both been surprised by it, too. I've gotten to be good friends with an atheist woman. She lives out in New York. This is through the internet. She's it's been an atheist all of her life. We're very, very different people, but I like her,
Yeah.
And she likes me. The thing is that she's got a human heart, and she's told me, if you told me 10 years ago that I would have had anything respectful to say about any Catholic, I would have totally given you the side eye. But she's found herself in the last year or two getting to know a whole bunch of Catholics with whom she hugely agrees on a whole lot of things, and it's been a real surprise to her. That it is. I like that we are something in common.
Yeah, somebody wrote a review of Misfit Faith on Amazon a couple days ago, and she said, I'm pretty much an atheist, but I read this book in one sitting, and I have not been able to stop thinking about it, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Fantastic. Well done.
We're all atheists sometimes. I'm agnostic most of the time, even as a Catholic. I talk about that a lot in the book. Once you are wrong once, you're freed up to be wrong again and again and again, and there's something liberating about that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something disarming for people, especially non-religious people, to see someone like us have sincere doubt and express unknowing and ambiguity and a comfort with not knowing all the answers, not having all the quick responses. That kind of fundamentalism, which exists both in religious and secular worlds, is just so unattractive to me. Mm-hmm. I would much rather embrace the doubt and the ambiguity, especially because, it, like you said, Mark, it builds bridges rather than building walls between you and some atheist woman in New York who all of a sudden realizes, gosh, I respect Catholics. Who knew that was possible?
Yeah. And that is, I think that one of the reasons, frankly, that God chose, out of all the people that he could possibly have chosen to be the cornerstone of the church, the reason that I think Jesus very carefully and deliberately chose Peter was that he had such a phenomenal talent for being wrong. epically wrong, over and over again, spectacularly wrong. But he also had the ability, which was the really key thing, of being able to say, I was wrong. You know, it's the only thing I can see that distinguishes him from Judas Iscariot. He was wrong, and then he went back and said, I was wrong, please forgive me. And and Judas was wrong and said, I am he made the weirdly prideful choice to say, I am the worst person who has ever lived. No one has ever been as wrong as me. Even God can't forgive me. which is a really strangely prideful thing to say, you know. So I'm grateful to Peter, because Peter is somebody who had the, you know, again, through suffering, had the cocksureness bled out of him, and it made him, it made him so great.
Yeah, there's something beautiful about that humility. Yeah. I'm growing in it, and I hope to continue to grow in it. And largely the book is kind of talking about that a lot, because it's hard. But like I said, being wrong once frees you up to do it again, and you start taking yourself less and less seriously the more you realize the kind of provisional nature of your own knowledge and your own opinions.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, and it's a different thing than loss of faith. It's actually a growth in faith. That kind of, I'm just not sure, I had to.
Well, faith is not the absence of doubt. Faith is what you do when you're filled with doubts. It's like trying to be brave when there's nothing to be scared of. You can't be. You can only be brave when there are things to be scared of. And likewise, faith is strongest, like you just said, when there are doubts.
Yeah.
That's when faith gets an opportunity to actually manifest itself.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about the relationship of love and law. You discussed this.
Yeah, well, it ties right in with God as Father, unpack it, but, Paul makes the point in Galatians 3 and 4 that God's people are now grown up because Jesus has come. We're not like Israel under the law, like little children who are heirs, but who still have to be babysat by laws, by do not touch, do not taste, do not handle. We have, because of the new covenant, we have grown up and entered into the age of maturity. And so therefore, to cower in fear at the foot of Mount Sinai, the way Hebrews describes Moses doing, is to live under the shadow of that old covenant. Whereas we come to the mountain which can't be touched, we come to Mount Zion, we are children of the living God. And if God is a father, then the proper lens through which to understand his dealings with us is not law, but love, right? St. John says in chapter 4, God is love. And when we see God as Father, it allows us to see his love for us as not something that we have to earn, not something that we have to qualify ourselves for, quite the opposite. I don't treat my kids that way. Mm-hmm. And if grace builds on nature, then by arguing from the greater lesser to the greater, God doesn't treat us that way either, because he is the archetypal father, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he loves us in a way that we can't even fathom loving our own children.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, before we go, where can people get your book?
Anywhere books are sold, but Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And if you want a signed copy, write me personally, and I can make that happen for you.
All right. The book is Misfit Faith. It's by Jason Stellman. Rush right out and get it. I want to thank you, Jason, for being on the show. I want to thank you, Michael Litchens, as well. We will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Our producer today was Danny Head, and you've been listening to Connecting the Dots with me, Mark Shea, your host. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.